Jojo Rabbit is a 2019 American film written and directed by Taika Waititi with Roman Griffin Davis as the title character, 10-year-old Johannes Jojo Betzler, an emerging Hitler youth. Set in the last year of the Second World War, Jojo struggles to find his place as his enthusiasm for the nationalist cause is out of sync with his taste for doing actual violence. To boost his confidence and combat his isolation and loneliness, Jojo invents a friendship with an imaginary, bungling, and insecure Hitler, played by director Waititi. Scarlett Johansson plays Jojo's mother, a member of the resistance, hiding Elsa, a young Jewish teenager, in the attic of their home. Elsa, played by Thomasine McKenzie, becomes Jojo's confidant as he seeks to understand and document Jewish traits through his skewed lens. Jojo Rabbit was released this past October 18th, 2019, and has been damned and praised in the press, many of the reviews coming out before the film's release. Now a month later, cooler heads seem to have prevailed, and the conversation around the film has become much more insightful. As one reviewer writes, Taika Waititi is, quote, a filmmaker of Jewish and Maori descent, so he knows a thing or two about white supremacy. He certainly knows how to jab at its vulnerabilities. The hallmark of Kiwi comedy is deflation of grandeur. Naomi Kanori, welcome to KBOO. Thanks for joining me for this review.
Thank you, Denise. It's really, really nice to be here.
Jojo Rabbit has been marketed as this anti-hate satire, and that seems typical of movie studios marketing, where they sort of actually try to cover up what the film's really about or details about the film that might keep people from actually wanting to come out and see it. We feel like there's certainly a lot more going on in this film than just love prevails over hate. We'll try to unpack a lot of that and hopefully raise some questions. And you have a lot of thoughts about the way that this film is centered on children and the role of children in the film, but also in war.
Well, it seems to me that one of the most remarkable characteristics of the film is that there are two young people who are ostensibly on two different sides of a situation. One is a young Jewish woman, Elsa, who lives in the attic of the house that is Jojo's home, unbeknownst to him, and he discovers her eventually. In their relationship, we see childhood being defined by the violence of adults, by a situation of war. And even in our own minds, we're looking for innocent and guilty parties. We're trying to reconcile the space where one or the other of them might be in the right or the wrong. This is a movie about how we see children in conflict, in terms of who's redeemable, who's irredeemable, what is a victim, who is not entitled to victim status. And so those are questions that occur to me in the viewing of the film and in considering the film.
And we talked a little bit about how the film mirrors the conditions that we live in, and just thinking about children and thinking about bullying. It's well established, even through the comedy of the early part of the film, that Jojo is on the downside of power, and he gets his name as a result of his inability to actually do violence to an extremely vulnerable being, a rabbit. And the taunting and the anger and hostility of the other youth in the camp is evident. That really stood out for me. This is relevant and timely, not just because we're dealing with white supremacy, the rise of fascism around the world, right-wing governments, we could go on, but because kids are experiencing violence in their day-to-day lives on a regular basis. It includes what happens to them in schools by their peers.
Well, it seems to me that that's part and parcel of the rise and the expansion of white supremacy. The continuing story of fascism is that we are now living in a time in which children's developmental experience is earmarked by isolation, by diminished self-esteem, loneliness, interfamilial violence, systemic violence within institutions, schools, through social services, etc. And we can't expect that these things don't nourish that situation. This is the cost of being included. The cost of inclusion is a hazing for many children. And I would say that is a foundational aspect of white supremacy.
That indoctrination, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And we could also say that indoctrination doesn't just happen around white supremacy. It happens, let's say, in our own country where we believe the story or the narrative of U.S. exceptionalism, the mm-hmm. idea that mm-hmm. we do no wrong around the world. What we do is for everyone's own good, mm-hmm. to use the language a parent might use with their child.
So often children are really deeply hip to what's not good, and they will work to give it a good face. They will often mm-hmm. create an ally in the process of trying to have some sense of self-preservation with that which they innately know is wrong, is violent or damaging. So in the film, I'm thinking about that too, mm-hmm. you know, because he can't quite cut the mustard, right?
Yeah, we see him hesitate in many scenes that can be both funny and also horrifying. For example, the book burning, where mm-hmm. he hesitates to actually throw the book. And mm-hmm. it seems like he is drawn to participate through that sense of belonging and that need of belonging. There's an expression of joy that these kids are having when they're burning these books. I mean, his remarkable ability to expose the horror with that bit of humor and also through this lens of innocence. This is not the first that he's used children mm-hmm. as a vehicle to explore something in his films. One thing that marks Jojo's existence is his isolation. He lives with his mom. Father is away. He understands his father to be at war, but also hears that his father is a coward. He spends most of his time either in this hostile environment with the Hitler Youth or with his mother in their home. So the point at which Jojo discovers that there is someone living upstairs in the attic, we have a good solid sense of his isolation and his loneliness.
As well, we have that sense in his imagined friend who takes the shape of Adolf Hitler.
Right, who is kind of bungling and has insecurities, also blows up.
Right, he manages to be a reflection of the things that it seems that Jojo needs to be reassured of our normal human responses to insecurity, to fear, etc. And he fulfills that until Jojo starts to question, through his relationship to Elsa, the Jewish girl living in the attic, through that relationship he starts to question the things that he's had camaraderie with this extension of himself around. And that's where you see the imaginal character of Hitler start to kind of fight back mm-hmm. and become who Hitler was.
Right. Kind of loses his grip on Jojo.
Yep.
Jojo does go through something that changes him. He no longer qualifies to
right.
be a part of the war, the mm-hmm. nationalist project
mm-hmm. right.
in the same way, and is relegated to the sidelines, putting up Nazi propaganda and wandering around in his little uniform. You know, one thing I thought was interesting is the way that the uniform is so important to him. And that could be true for any of us who've ever dressed up as Peter Pan or Batman or whatever, that somehow there's such a joy in dressing up in a uniform of some kind or a costume of some kind. And his sensibility about what's really going on only is channeled through these completely whacked out propaganda about what Jewish people are like. So by the mm-hmm. the point that he ends up discovering Elsa in the attic, their engaging becomes very toying but important. It is the point at which he gets to transform.
Well, because what she does with him that I think is different than what he's experienced with the other young people that he's involved with who are members of the Hitler Youth is she teases him. But it's the kind of teasing that is also accompanied by a kind of care. It's the kind of teasing that invites you closer. It doesn't alienate. It asks you questions. It seems to me her teasing, asking of him something that allows him to wonder, and it's offering him keys to the things that he's afraid of, to his own insecurity, that is a deeply generous human act that she is able to extend to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game changer for him.
Because their first encounter is not so loving, but they come to an agreement that they will be each other's secret.
Right.
And that Precisely. Then plays off of this idea that he continues to have a kind of imaginary relationship with someone who's actually real.
Mm-hmm. She says, "We're just like you, except that we're human," which seems to indicate that there is something that she recognizes him to be in the process of losing as a human being that is still intact somehow in her understanding of herself within the larger context of war. Mm-hmm. As somebody who can see so many facets, you know, that comes as a necessary response in a situation where one is trying to survive, that you can see as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does she see that, but she sees that he is at risk of losing something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's 10.
Yeah, he's a child.
Yeah. His capacity to do harm is there. We see that. He does it in this very childlike manner. Once he feels like he has feelings for Elsa, he begins to write these letters to her from her boyfriend, not realizing the kind of pain that could exact on her. To be told by your boyfriend that he no longer loves you. His intent is to win her over for himself, but he actually has then the power to do quite a lot of harm.
She knows it's a ruse the whole time.
Yeah.
But it still hurts her.
Yeah.
Because he's doing it. It's like, how could you do this, you mean little kid?
Mm-hmm.
What's making you so mean? You're 10. Why?
We see that he has a loving mother. Mm-hmm. She is conceivably using him as a bit of a smokescreen to her own actions in the resistance. But she's invested in him seeking joy and having a great imagination and love.
I think one reviewer put it sort of like she's put herself at risk and she's put him at risk. But rather than that being interpreted as some kind of act of gross neglect, it's an act of even reserving for him this deeply human act.
Mm-hmm.
Should he survive?
Mm-hmm.
Should he survive intact as a human being, this will be something he has to carry that will connect him to other people, because he could just as easily survive physically mm-hmm. without that internal capacity to love and to connect and to relate intact.
Mm-hmm.
She's making sure he has that.
Mm-hmm. And we both feel like the film can't necessarily be distilled down to any one thing. Maybe more than anything, it's a coming of age story in a very imaginative way on the part of the director, who has proven himself to take those kinds of things on. I mean, this is a director who made What We Do in the Shadows. If people haven't seen that, they might want to check it out. Yeah. It's fanciful. It's ridiculous. It's deeply humorous. He's entrenched his career in that kind of work. And so it makes sense that then he moved forward to try to challenge or raise questions about white supremacy, or even just to plain old set out to mock it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that he do that through the eyes of a child.
Mm-hmm. Hunt for the Wilder People is another one of his films. And in that movie, one of the nemesis predatory authority figures is on a bandwagon to subvert the delinquent spirit of Ricky Baker, who is a young kid who has been in the foster system. And Taika Waititi really takes it upon himself to show the supremacist violent arm of the state in her character. And slowly but surely, he punches a huge hole in it to show how humanity is really pressed down by these structures that are conjured by the indoctrination of Western structures, how the state creates power out of insecurity in the character of that foster system probation officer, the insecurity that drives her supposed benevolence and creates in her a sense of supremacy, is this very important thing for Waititi to diffuse, to show the weakness in it. There have been reviewers who have claimed that This is a movie that gets lost in sort of a good German trope, the good side of the oppressor. Really, I think what he's doing is he's saying, you can punch a big hole in this. And you can see that inside of that is this incredibly problematic, developed insecurity that only has one way to kind of unroll itself, and that's in the expression of supremacy.
Right, the path to belonging.
The path to belonging.
He also uses very relatable imagery and music in the film. He doesn't stick to time frames. This is, I think, true of many of his films.
Or accents.
Or accents, yeah. Humor is obviously both essential to the film and has caused a lot of the concern, and I would say there's a bit of uproar as well. But humor is this deeply important avenue or lifeline for Waititi in all of his films.
One of the critical responses is based in the assumption that one is laughing at the tragedy of genocide during this particular historical context, the Holocaust. And really, that's not what's happening at all. That humor is used as a survival mechanism, a way to stay buoyant under extremely difficult and challenging circumstances. Humor allows the imagination to stay intact and to see oneself at the end of the day not as simply the sum of what's been done to you. It's a way to shake that off. At the end of the day, that's not all of who I am. I'm more than a victim, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who still has all of these experiences. Mm-hmm. And will do everything I can to continue to have joy, to continue to have a full range of emotions and psychological responses, deep responses to my life. I will not just be diminished that way. And laughter, rebellious humor are wonderful tools that humans have, who have experienced these kinds of atrocities, have held on to, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of push back that violence.
Naomi, thanks for sitting in on this one. We're going to make sure that you come back to the Old Mole real soon.
Okay.
We'll give you a chance to recover, and then we'll have you on back. But we definitely think this film is very much worth seeing, and it's relatable in our times. It's relevant to our existence, really in a state of perpetual conflict on all levels, from schools to war, imperialism, all of it. We're stuck in this cycle of conflict, and I think that state can only really continue until we can collectively challenge everything that we know, everything we think we know about who we are.
Well, and I think in closing, I would add to that that what Taika Waititi also offers us is, as my friend Denise here has put it before, is some recovery time. You know, in the big picture, like the humor and the laughter as a response to getting into really difficult subject matter is a real gift to all of us. And I would also encourage people to check out his other work, Eagle versus Shark, Boy, Hunt for the Wilder People, What We Do in the Shadows, and just really enjoy and appreciate this individual, Taika Waititi's creative expression, his gift that he offers all of us.
Absolutely. Well said. This has been Denise Morris and Naomi Kanori reviewing Jojo Rabbit.
Thank you.